was The Logical Song by Supertramp. That's an old song, and I know I've used it before, but it's just so appropriate here tonight because our guest is Dr. Bernie Signal, and he's written a book about raising our kids to feel loved and to be kind and to make a difference. And I think that's a responsibility of parents, and in this case of the song that you just heard, The Logical Song, this young man ended up committing suicide shortly after this song was recorded. And I think the new book by Dr. Siegel, Love, Magic, and Mud Pies, is going to help us become better parents. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host for Sound Health on BBS Radio. And for the next hour, I think Dr. Bernie and I will be delighted to join us, have you join us for a bit of conversation. My electricity is flipping around here, and it's going on and off, and this is just really strange. For a bit of conversation, so I'm being a little bit distracted here because of the electricity flipping here on me. Tonight, Dr. Bernie Siegel is our guest, but as usual, we have a few announcements. I will make them very quick because this book, I think, that we're going to talk about tonight is going to change a lot of lives. So announcement one, last week we had Steve Halperin as our guest, and he had so much fun, he's agreed to become a regular, and we're going to begin to create a CD to bring his special kind of music and our research together using the frequency and sounds that we've been experimenting here on at the Sound Health Institute. And as of many of you know, we've been using frequencies to reduce back pain, so that's going to be our first project to bring Stephen's music together, and we'll do a CD, and we'll see how that works. Announcement two, I'm going to be appearing next week in Chicago at the Health Freedom Expo, and you can find more about that at healthfreedomexpo.com. We've got several booths there. We're going to be taking vocal profiles and sort of try to help you to find your inner self. You can lie with your words, but your voice doesn't lie. And three, you can join us for demo classes. They're free about vocal profiling and help you reveal the real you. Heather at vocalprofiling.com. Heather, H-E-A-T-H-E-R, at vocalprofiling.com can help you out getting scheduled for those. We would rather you use the email because our phones have just been overloaded since I appeared on Coast to Coast, even though we've doubled the staff and the phone lines, and we're still behind getting back to people. But we will get back to everyone. Okay, on to our guest, Dr. Bernie Siegel, who I've been told likes to be called Bernie. Is that Bernie or Dr. Bernie? Dr. Bernie, are you with us? Hello? Michelle, I think we've lost our guest.
Extension of being the same.
Okay, on to our guest, Dr. Bernie Siegel, who I'm told prefers to be called Bernie. Is that Dr. Bernie?
Well, I love to be Bernie,
okay,
so
well,
it doesn't impose any burden on me.
Okay. You are nearly a household word anyway.
But let me jump back a minute, because
okay,
you mentioned something about suicide, and I, you know, couldn't help but want to add, this is a big part of why I've written the book in terms of people's self-destructive behavior and what I see in support groups. You know, why do you commit suicide? It's when you don't know how to eliminate what's killing you, you kill yourself. And I often at my lectures read this line from Woody Allen. One guy's terribly depressed about life, and he goes on and on about the dark, bleak, you know, and when he finishes, his friend says, "What are you doing Saturday night?" He says, "I'm committing suicide." And his friend says, "How about Friday night?" You know, people laugh. But, you know, you ever stop and think about that? If you knew you're going to be dead on Saturday, why not have a nice time Friday? See, now what I see literally with people with cancer, and there was a guy written up in London who spent all his money when he was told he had 2 months to live, having a wonderful time, and now he feels perfectly well, no sign of cancer, and he wants to sue his doctor. You know, well, the doctor didn't make a mistake. He went home and lived his life in a way that gave his body a different image. And what I try to tell the high school students is, don't kill yourself. See? In other words, this is a biblical line. He who seeks to save his life will lose it. You become what everybody else wants. Yeah, that's why we read about suicide. An Eagle Scout is told by his parents. These are true stories. Your grades are going down, so you can't do all that volunteer work. You have to study. He put a gun to his head and killed himself because he wanted to be out helping the world, not sitting in his room studying. So what people need to do is lose the untrue self and life, and save your life, and don't wait till somebody tells you you're going to be dead in a month to close your office and go pick up a violin or move to Colorado or Florida or whatever. But what I see is that people are still carrying the burden of their parenting, and it's killing them, literally. And we know from statistics that loved children have a fraction of the illness rate of unloved children when they get to be adults. In other words, an unloved child has almost 100% serious illness rate by the time they're in their 50s, and a loved child, about 25% of them will have a serious illness. And so go to an assisted living facility, ask the 80 and 90-year-old if your parents love you, and almost everyone says, yeah, of course, sure. Go to high school and ask that, and you'll get a different answer.
How did we get there?
How did we get there? I think it comes with all the depersonalizing and separation of families. I mean, depersonalizing in the sense even of answering machines and everything else, larger and larger businesses. I mean, Carl Jung decades ago said, the larger the organization, the more the individual becomes like a vicious animal. So look at all these CEOs of major companies who are sitting in prison today, not to mention politicians, because they stop thinking about people. They think about money and politics and the hell with the people. And when we think about people, see, that's why when your children have children, you are called a grandparent. And when they have kids, you're called a great grandparent. You know why? Because by then you've learned something, and you're much more loving and less judgmental and a lot more laid back than the parents were and you were as a parent.
That's why it's so much easier to be a grandma.
Yeah.
We're going to be taking calls tonight. The toll-free number is 877-876-5227. Toll-free in Canada, 888-810-8322. And if those are busy, there's a direct line, 530-876-3222. And if you forget those numbers, just go to bbsradio.com, and it's right on the front page. We will also, as usual, be monitoring Sound Health at soundhealth.org and radio at vocalprofiling.com. It is a delight to have you on. I couldn't believe it when they said that you're going to be on the show, and you sent us this delightful book that I had to trace down. I had to yank it out of somebody's hands. They wouldn't give it up. Love, Magic, and Mud Pies. You told us a bit about how this book came about. Why do you think it's needed?
Why is it needed? Because what I know is, I mean, really, if you want to solve the world's problems, just bring up every child to feel loved. I mean it. We would eliminate wars. To paraphrase a statement from Golda Meir, who was the prime minister in Israel years ago, she said, when we love our children, she was talking about the Arabs and the Israelis, but basically, you see, when we love our children more than we hate our enemies, wars will cease. And I have a bumper sticker from one of our kids that says, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. So if every child grows up loved with a reverence for life, how can you hurt anything? I mean, you don't. You stop. You talk. You learn to understand, forgive. You communicate. You realize we're one family. See, let me ask you a test question. Where are we all alike? Where a photograph of you or me, nobody would know which one it was of. What is it, a picture of?
I don't think I understand the question. If there was a photograph of you or me?
Yeah, and nobody could tell which one of us it was. What's it a picture of?
Two people. You and I.
No. It's a picture of one of us.
Ah.
But what part of us is it a picture of? Where are we all alike? You asked that in the fourth grade. See, if I asked the fourth grade what I just asked you, what picture, and nobody would know which one of us in this classroom it is, and the kids immediately yell at you, our insides, our hearts. And then they write me letters the next week saying, I went home and I said to my parents, where are we all alike? And it took them 15 minutes to figure it out. See, we've lost track of the fact that we're all one family. We're all the same color inside. What's on the outside? That's so we can tell who we're talking to and, you know, to differentiate each other. So the differences are not to fight over, make conflict over. We're a family. And you know, it may be that when the earth is almost destroyed, we'll all get together and say, hey, we better get together, stop fighting, and try to save this place because we're all living here.
I just flunked the test question.
Yeah, well, you're a grown-up. Don't feel bad. That's okay. I mean, all the grown-up.
I'm a grandma grown-up. I should know that question.
Have a lot of trouble with it. But you see, I would love to have that kind of picture in the lobby of every public building, and next to it, here's another test question. What would you hang up in the public buildings and schools? Above it, it says, look at how beautiful and meaningful life is. What would you hang beneath that?
A butterfly.
Yeah. And the answer is a mirror.
A mirror.
So when everybody comes in, they will look in the mirror, and it'll say, look at how beautiful and meaningful life is, and you'll go home feeling better. See, I spoke at a high school a few months ago, 1,600 students. And I stood up there, and the reason I was there, I have to commend the mother. Her child was killed in an auto accident on the way home from school. And it was an error in diagnosis, I mean, at the hospital. He died because they misdiagnosed him, and he bled to death. Now, instead of suing everybody, she said, what I want the hospital to do is improve care, take better care of kids. I want to have lectures at the high school to help the kids deal with loss and pain. And so she has made something. She's turned the curse into a blessing. So I was the speaker. And I said to 1,600 kids, if you need a father, you've got one. Here's my phone number. Here's my email address. Because I learned from some suicidal kids who said to me, because I continued to love them. One of them finally said, you're my CD. I said, what is that? She said, you're my chosen dad. So I've learned, and I offer this to the kids. I say, you need a CD? You got one. What I know is that, and actually only two or three called me because they went home feeling better, saying, do you realize what he said? I must be worth something. I don't have to call him. See, because he said I could. I don't need to. And that's the part so that teachers, clergy, doctors, relatives, neighbors, yeah, we can reparent kids by persistently loving them. And I didn't say like what they're doing. I said love them. And then they stop being self-destructive 6 or 12 months down the road because they passed the test. You know, they've driven you nuts, done everything wrong, and you kept saying I love you. So they realize, okay, they really do love me. Now I'll start behaving.
I remember reading a book when my kids were growing up, and it said, I hate you, I hate you. I never want to speak to you again, but could you take me to the mall? And it was like right. the name of the book.
Yeah, I mean, we have five children who are grown now. And, yeah, we went through that all the time. I mean, you know, some of the funny lines I put in the book because, one, the five of them were, oh, God, you know, the food is flying. And you walk in the kitchen, and it's a disaster. And I yelled out loud, you can choose peace or you can choose conflict. And our daughter has some hearing impairment. And she immediately turned and said, I'll have pizza. And, you know, then everybody stops and bursts out laughing. And, you know, the problem's gone. And I learned, if you have a sense of humor. And yet we learned, the kids learned to control me with a simple statement. Dad, you're not in the operating room now. So when I became overbearing, you know, the surgeon in charge, they would say, Dad, you're not in the operating room now. And I would calm down. And when they were driving me nuts, they knew my code message was, your mother and I will never get a divorce. Why not? Because neither one of us wants the children. And, you know, we'd all laugh and everybody'd settle down and we'd start again. But they knew they were loved. At the same time, you know, they knew that, hey, you have to follow rules and there's discipline that goes on here. I always say to people, when they say, how should I raise a child? I say, get a puppy, go to a veterinarian, say, how do I raise this puppy? And you will hear these words because they have been stated by veterinarians I know. Love, trust, respect, consistency, affection, discipline, exercise. Yeah. See, everybody, I'm going to read you something in a minute from John Steinbeck, but everyone has aggression. It's normal, okay? Psychiatrists will tell you that. But what does a healthy child do? There's a kid in our town who built a basketball court for a school that doesn't have one. I mean, he's digging holes, smashing things, knocking rocks. See, his aggression turned into something beautiful. So it's one of his things that he's doing to become an Eagle Scout. Now, your son could become a famous football player, and you're in the stands cheering while he's knocking people over, and everybody's cheering. Oh, look what he's doing. Isn't that wonderful? Now, then your son goes to school and becomes a bully or shoots somebody. No, it's not so wonderful. And listen to this by John Steinbeck, written 55 years ago, and it is quoted on the cover of a DVD on the origins of love and violence. The greatest terror a child can have is that he is not loved, and rejection is the hell he fears. I think everyone in the world, to a large or small extent, has felt rejection. And with rejection comes anger. And with anger, some kind of crime in revenge for the rejection. And with the crime, guilt. And there is the story of mankind. Wow. And you think of Virginia Tech and a lot of other things, and that's it right there. If somebody had come along sometime and said, I love you, I care about you, and that could be a psychiatrist who says, let me see you again next week. I really care about you and want to help you. I used to hug patients who were totally self-destructive and never did anything I said. And I would always say, I'll see you next week, and I'd give them a hug. And I knew that somewhere down the road, they would come in, having taken a bath, gotten a job, getting off drugs. Why? Because I kept saying, I'll see you next week. Not, there's no point in seeing you, you're not doing anything I want, goodbye. That's what they got from everybody. But when somebody doesn't reject you, that shakes you up. When somebody loves you, it's like getting hit in the head with a baseball bat. And I mean it. Love, you know, when we say kill with kindness, it's not an accident. And what's love blind to? Your faults. So love if you want to drive people crazy.
Do you think a part of what's going on in our schools, the bullying and the mudslinging, comes directly out of this fear of rejection and not being loved?
Yeah. See, the opposite of love is indifference. A lot of people don't know that. They say, oh, fear, hate. No, the opposite of love is indifference. So when you're driving everybody crazy, you get attention. I mean, I have to say, you know, with our five children, one of them, who I always call the angel, came to me and said, I don't get 20% of your time. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you have five children. We should each get 20%. I said, your brother's driving us out of our minds. So he gets 40%. And I explained that to him. I thought, truthfully, it was wonderful. You see, he came to me and said, I'm not getting your time. Now, he could have acted out and become worse than his brother and then gotten more time. But he was smart enough to walk up and say, how come you're not loving me as much as, you know, my brother? And we said, we do love you as much as your brother, but there's an issue going on here in the house, and we need to give him time because of his troubles. See, then the fact that I'm in the bedroom at the end of the hall and they don't spend a lot of time with me isn't that they don't love me. It's because I don't cause trouble, so they honor me and trust me. While my brother's right next to their room, you know, my parents' room, and they're watching him all the time. So once the kids understand, then forgiveness comes in. But if they don't understand, yeah, then each one is going to act out to get more attention and cause more trouble, and, you'll go nuts with them. And you have to sit down and explain.
Was the son that wasn't getting attention okay with that explanation?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he was. I mean, he walked away knowing he was loved and that there was a problem, which he could see. You know what I mean? I mean, the fact that his brother was a problem wasn't, you know, strange to him. I mean, he's in the house and seeing that that's happening. So he could accept that. And I have to say, he went through a stage where he was very angry. It's like all the goodness, you know, all the anger that got stored up. Yeah, that's not healthy. See, let me say this, that if you have twin sisters, one is a sweet little kid who makes mommy and daddy happy and internalizes anger, and the other drives everybody nuts and is a little devil, the one who's more likely to get breast cancer is the sweet little kid. So I don't want the child to internalize anger. Yeah, I'd like him to come up to his parents and say, hey, I'm mad at you. You don't give me enough time. Fine, let's talk about it. So they knew that it's okay to make noise, and I mean that literally, that noise and love go together. And I've even been asked by our kids if I was getting a divorce, and I said one night to one of them, I'm sitting in the living room reading a newspaper. What does this come up for? He said, well, you yell a lot. I said, I yell and I don't like how I'm being treated, so I make noise so everybody will know. And he said, oh, the neighbors yelled a lot and they're getting divorced. I said, I love you, Mother, and it has nothing to do with my wanting a divorce. It's what I want in terms of care and attention. And so they learned that noise and love go together, that if you need help, need assistance, need time, okay, say something. You know, you don't necessarily have to yell, but you can come up and say, I need some time from you. And yes, and again, the magic in the book are these practical things. How do you make time? How do you give them special days? For instance, we had twins born the day after Christmas. That's a terrible time to have a birthday. You know, I mean, everybody's busy with Christmas and gifts. And so we had a birthday 6 months later for them when we had a big blast every June where all their friends from school came. And, you know, so they had a special day and they knew they love us. They're not overlooking our birthday. And there were other things, too, that when each child had a birthday, they got a special day when their parents would take them somewhere, whether it's to a city to do something fancy, or even just go to a movie or out to dinner, but they had their parents to themselves for a day. So there are many ways to do something simple. And we had family night, so they weren't mad at me because I'm a doctor on call, and I didn't get mad at them because they had friends and they were going out. So when I'm home, they're out. When you know, they're home, I'm on call. Then Thursday night is family night, and we all went roller skating together and had a wonderful time. And you can build that into your life and, you know, let the kids know in those simple ways that I care about you. And I can say today, you know, it's Father's Day and our whole family was together. And it's wonderful to talk about the old stories and laugh over, you know, their behavior and all the crazy things they did. But we can sit together and enjoy each other. And I may say the spouses of our children all think they have strange personalities. And I said, it's because they aren't afraid to speak up. I mean, our kids, five kids were born in 7 years, so there's a lot of sibling rivalry, which I learned about later, you know, that you're better off having kids less than a year apart or 5 years apart. Then they don't fight with each other. But ours, you know, yeah, so they learned, hey, we got to speak up. We got to, you know, make our presence known. And their spouses, like one of them, said all her siblings were spread over 14 years, and how different her family was than ours, where everybody was crammed into half that time. So it was obvious to them as we were speaking that there are reasons, you know, for their behavior and how they've grown up.
How do we as parents find that magic time, place where we create the child that comes and says, you're not giving me enough of your time, instead of creating the child that acts out in a negative way because they want attention, and if they don't get good attention, they'll seek the negative attention?
Well, I think you have to find ways to give them the attention, and it can be small things. As I said, you can take them to work with you for a day. Every one of our kids has been in the operating room at night or on weekends. I mean, we broke some rules, but I wanted them to see what I did and what, when I wasn't home, that what I was doing was important. So they spent time with me. I was a Cub Scout master, so I did a lot of things with all our kids, you know, and spent time with them and their activities. So, you know, it's not hard to build it into your life. I mean, heck, you can garden together. You know, you can take a hike. One of our sons, his son is a Cub Scout. They're going to Pennsylvania to, you know, study the Civil War sites. So they're doing things together on a weekend. And you can set those things up. You know, you take vacations together. We went off to farms up in Maine and spent a week or so there, you know, with the kids learning to ride horses and play with the farm animals. And, you know, we were just together, sleeping in the same room and everything else. And, you know, those are the memories that stay with the kids and help hold the family together. Robert Frost said in a poem that home is a place that when you go there, they have to take you in. And I think that's the thing. If the kids know they're loved, they can do a lot of crazy things, but they know, well, I can go home. They'll let me in. And, you know, that's the part that's so wonderful. See, you can be out in the world and never worry about being normal. That's only if you're inadequate, you try to be normal. But, you know, so you don't worry, am I normal? You go out and you live your life and you're unique, you're authentic, and everybody accepts you and you come home and you're not getting criticism. See,
we have a great... go ahead.
All right, well, I was going to quote you from a letter. Do you have time?
Yes,
all right.
We just got four emails, and so I want to read you, share those.
All right, let me just quote this, and then I'll stop, because this is from a woman who, when I was out lecturing, sat down in front of me in a bright red dress that was giving me a headache, and since her husband was with her, I wondered how he let her out of the house. When they were done, she handed me a letter to read, and it said, my mother was terribly... criticizing, always told me they could never be proud of me, I never accomplished anything, I was put down and belittled my entire life, quote, and my mother's words were always eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer. Now, when this woman learned she had cancer, she said, my mother always dressed me in black, brown, and navy, so I went out and I bought a red dress and high heel shoes. When I read that, you know, I said, I forgive you. But it's, you know, that you have to get cancer to buy a red dress. And up to the age of 6, the child's brain is like that of somebody under hypnosis. So what your parents say to you is embedded in there, and it's hard to clean it out when you get to be a teenager.
Wow. Well, these emails that came in are pretty poignant. Mm. I've been reading them. I've been listening to you and trying to read them and sort of sort things out, too. This one lady... and she's written this before, a tough survivor. I have two jobs, so I don't have much time with my kids, but I make time with them by making them a part of my life as I do things for them. When we are home, we do things together, whether it's making supper or doing laundry. So many mothers let their kids play, in quotes, while they do their chores, and that teaches them wrong, that they don't have to be part. And even if you don't have much, you can have time together. Hmm. And I think negative attention comes from the parents not drawing boundaries. And she doesn't say much about that more. But, boy, in just a few words, it summed up a lot of what's going on. If people think they don't have time while everybody cooks supper, so I'll do
it together. Yeah, do it together.
Yeah,
I mean, some of our kids... while they were kids, were terrific cooks, mm-hmm. because it became, again, something creative. It's like their aggression went into making a meal, and they're wonderful cooks today because it became creative. You know, they were like artists. I mean, it's not their business, if you know what I mean. They're not running restaurants, But, boy, you're proud of them because, wow, look at the meal you made. So, you know, there are many ways that they can be, creative and, you know, work together with their parents.
Here's one just for you. Dr. Burney, I love your book. I love what you write. But I was fastly losing faith in the medical profession. You have my trust, and I can't think of another doctor I trust. Thank you. That's kind of neat.
I have to say that even some of my family members who are having problems sometimes know more than their doctors. And again, what I call the villain or the culprit, in a sense, is medical education. See, I don't think it's a real education. I think it's a lot of information. But you're not taught how to care for people, and you're not taught how to take care of yourself and your feelings. I mean, think about what it's like when you can't cure somebody, and you're wondering why God made a world where children die of cancer. And, I mean, a lot of stuff goes on that's never discussed. And I have to tell you, I'm just as disappointed in the sense that 30 years ago I wrote to a couple of medical school deans telling them they made me a wonderful surgeon, but I don't know how to take care of people, you know, the emotions and the experience of people going through, and my own, and they didn't write back to me. Recently, I could see some changes happening in the schools and hospitals that I had written to. So I wrote again saying, it's nice to see this happening, and I still didn't even get a letter back from the dean of the medical school. I mean, that really bothers me, that he can't take a minute to say, thank you for your letter, thanks for the compliment, got your letter. I mean, I don't care if he sent me a form letter saying, your letter arrived. You know, like if I wrote to the president, I don't expect a personal note back. But I expect, you get a form letter saying, we received your letter. And so it is so, again, separated from people that it's tragic. And I see changes happening, but they're decades behind. If I were in charge of medical school, basically I'd make every doctor a patient and not let them graduate from medical school without spending a week in a hospital, just to start with. So you got an idea, what is it like to experience an illness? Stop with the diagnosis and the treatment. See, a lot of young medical students, when they get to medical school, write this on their application. And this came from a dean of a medical school. He said, what I'm seeing more and more is this sentence, I'm fascinated by the human body. That's why I want to be a doctor. Well, there's a problem. People come into the office. See, it's like saying, I want to be a veterinarian because I love animals, but people bring the pets in. So you have to learn how to take care of people. And what changed my life years ago was a patient of mine saying to me, when we both attended a workshop, because I was so unhappy as a doctor, she had cancer. She said, you're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me, so I need to know how to live between office visits. See, what I basically learned was when you help people live, they don't die when they're supposed to. And now I'm not considered crazy. You know, I was on all the famous talk shows, everybody yelling at me, telling me you're nuts and you're blaming people and you're telling them it's their fault. No, I wasn't saying that. What I was saying is look at your life when you get sick. See, look at Elizabeth Edwards. Their oldest child was killed in an auto accident. 2 years later, she develops breast cancer. Do I think that's an accident? No. Or look at Christopher Reeve's wife, who develops cancer and dies. Do I think that's an accident? No. Am I blaming them? No. But think of what it's like to go through the death of your child, your husband being quadriplegic and dying. I mean, think of what that is doing to you stressfully. And just think about Monday. We have more heart attacks, suicides, strokes, and illnesses on Monday, okay? So if doctors learn to help people deal with their lives and heal their lives as well as treat their illnesses, then people would say thank you. And doctors have to have an open mind. Stop blaming patients. You know, when you can't explain things or don't understand, keep an open mind. Say, let's watch. Let's get other opinions. Let's see. Just to be open, because I know with, you know, personal illnesses and myself and our family, how we have struggled to find the right physicians who don't blame the patient. You know, you must be crazy, you're neurotic, you're this, you're that. No, I'm sick, and you can't explain it because you don't understand what's causing it.
I'm hearing underneath all your words this idea of people need and want to be appreciated. I have to admit, I didn't read all your book. I flipped through it and just devoured little pieces.
Oh, that's
pieces.
All right.
Do you talk about appreciation in here?
Well, you know what? I don't think I put in the book, but you know what I have ultimately come to is that we all need to be born again. That's what it's about. We need to be rebirthed. I always have talked about life as a labor pain, see? But, and that can include having to go through surgery, chemotherapy, you know, treatments, or the emotional problems. But if the pain is about you becoming more complete, then, as I said, the curse becomes a blessing. The pain doesn't hurt as much, whether you're literally a woman in labor, see, surrounded by loved ones or lying alone in a hospital room. Guess who needs more cesarean sections and more anesthesia? So if somebody's loved, then the pain of life is much less. And if you know you're birthing yourself, it's much less. So if you decide to have surgery to give yourself life, you will come out of surgery and have less pain than somebody who says, I'm mutilated because my doctor prescribed it. What choice did I have? Well, you could have said no to your doctor. But this is what I've seen. So life is a labor pain. And every, you know, addiction groups, therapy groups, religions, the message is be born again, rebirth, transformation. You know, like when you talked about the butterfly, well, listen to this from Solzhenitsyn, who had cancer and wrote this in Cancer Ward. One of the men is reading a book. He says, oh, there are cases of self-induced healing, not recovery through treatment, but actual healing, see? It was as though self-induced healing fluttered out of the great open book like a rainbow-colored butterfly for everyone to see, and they all held up their cheeks for its healing touch as it flew past. Only the gloomy Padiyev croaked, I suppose for that you need to have a clear conscience. That's everything you need to know about life right on that page, because Solzhenitsyn has been there. He had cancer. And why? The butterfly is a symbol of transformation. What dissolves away? The caterpillar. Boom, you get a butterfly. It needs to struggle to get out of the cocoon. Don't help it or it won't expand its wings properly and its circulation and so forth. And why a rainbow? Because every color expresses an emotion. I do a lot of work with dreams and drawings, and I can tell you that. It's like red is a color of emotion or passion. So each color you pick when you're drawing a picture says something. And when he says rainbow, it means all the colors are in order. And yeah, you need a clear conscience. You know, you need to be at peace with yourself and understand. And when you do that, yeah, you can be reborn. And as I said, every religion discusses that, finding the way, the path, changing your name when you have a problem. It goes on and on. But they're all telling you the same thing. And at an AA meeting, it's fake it till you make it. And what I learned was when you put performers on a stage and draw their blood, put them in a comedy, their immune function improves and the cortisol levels, stress hormone levels go down, put them in a tragedy while they're acting and the opposite happens. So just acting the role is destructive. So what is my advice to everybody? Become the person you want to be. Find a role model and go and be that individual. And my sense of humor is to advise everybody to follow WWLD, what would do, and it's what would Lassie do. So pick a role model like Lassie, and you can't go wrong.
I see people being so upset with their flaws. They don't see them as something constructive.
That's why you look for coaches. I mean, the Sufi poet Rumi said, and in his time, mirrors were metal. See, and he said criticism polishes your mirror, and that's how I find good plumbers and doctors. I always say to them, are you criticized by the people you work with, the people you work for, and your family? And every good one says, yes. Why are they saying yes? Because they're learning from their mistakes and the people around them. In other words, as a doctor, if I've never been a patient and the patient tells me something that I could have done in a better way, I say, thank you. Now I'm a better doctor. I will never make that mistake again. Or a plumber, you know, comes back and says, sorry, not, there's something wrong with your house and the pipes in your house. Goodbye, I'll get another plumber. When they come back and say, I'm sorry, I've never run into this problem before, I just learned something, I'll take care of it now, it won't happen again. Okay, thank you. Anybody listening to this program who has never criticized, I can tell you, your family and the people you work with and for have given up on you because you don't listen, you make excuses.
Oh, I'm going to write that one down, not criticism, they've given up. That's beautiful. There's an email here that just, well, two almost, that makes you cry. It sounds like it's from a young man. I can't get close to my dad. He's just not a loving person. I remember once when I was very young, Dad was coming up the driveway. I came flying out of the house and grabbed him around the legs to hug and touch him. He unclamped my hands, set me away from him about 2 feet, and shook my hand. I was about 4 years old, and it took a long time for me to get over that empty feeling. I thought he didn't love me for the longest time. I know he would do anything for me, but I realize now that it wasn't me, and I don't know how to help him.
I would say his dad was never touched as a child, and so couldn't handle it. I learned, you know, we had a lot of touching, and our kids hug each other. And I used to hug patients, and I realized some of them were like telephone poles. When I grabbed them, they would become just so rigid that I was intruding into their lives. And again, maybe one of them was sexually abused by a parent. Who knows? And who knows what happened to his father? So I learned to say, may I hug you? Or I need to hug you, you know, that I needed a hug. And then they would either say yes or no, and we would have permission. But what I'd say is, and I'm just sharing stories, that keep loving your father. Even if it's just holding his hand, ask him if you can massage his hand or his feet and gradually, you know, encompass a large area. And one day ask him, tell him you need a hug. Would he please hug you? You've had a very terrible day. The other is to literally keep loving verbally. There was someone in our group, who a support group that I run, who had alcoholic parents who never said, I love you, very similar to this man's father. And after she developed cancer, she started listening to me, you know, and she started saying, I love you, to her parents. And she'd come in and say, I've said I love you to them every day, twice a day. They never answer me. 3 months later, she came into the meeting with a big smile. I said, Mary, what's the big smile about? She said, I was late for work today, so I ran out of the house, and my parents were in the street screaming, you forgot something. She said, I have my lunch, I have my umbrella, I have my pocketbook. What'd I forget? You didn't say I love you today. And that's when they all had tears and embraced and started a new beginning, see? So use love as a weapon. As I said, kill with kindness, torment with tenderness. You go watch the show Don Quixote. Aldonza is a barmaid prostitute abused by men, and Don Quixote walks in and says, Dulcinea, I have sought thee, sung thee, dreamed thee, Dulcinea. Now I found thee, and the world shall know thy glory. And she says, stop tormenting me with your tenderness. She can't deal with it. When I heard that line, I thought, wow. But you see, he keeps loving her, and she changes. She can accept being Dulcinea. And that's the part, you know, that I'd say you have to decide if you want to keep loving your father. And you're not doing it so he'll love you. That's not love. See, that's got conditions. But, you know, if I knew I were going to die tomorrow, I'd rather die saying, hey, Dad, I love you. Whether he hugs me or not, who cares? But I would rather die loving. And I mean it. Even if somebody was robbing my house and said, I'm going to kill you, I'd say, I just want you to know I love you. And that's when they put the gun down. And I can tell you a lot of stories about that, too. You know, from serving robbers lunch to saying, I know behind that mask is someone you can love. And having people turn and run away because they couldn't deal with it.
Wow. Maybe we need
to I mean, you want to try it on a simple basis. Next time you take a parking space in the supermarket, you know, parking lot, that somebody else wanted, and they lower their window and start screaming at you, lower your window and say, I love you, and watch what they do. They back up and drive away because they don't know what the hell to do with you. See, if you lowered your window and screamed back, oh, sure, okay, let's yell at each other. Let's have a fight. But when you lower your window and say, I love you, yeah, wow.
Well, when that happened to me last, I got out of my car and told him, just a second, I'll move. You can back up, and I'll let you have the space because it's not important to me.
Right.
The space isn't, but what you feel about me is. And it was just awesome. Here's another one. Well, I should say to this young man, I don't know if he's young or not, but to this guy who wrote in about his dad, it's not him. I think that's the important thing.
Yeah,
he's not.
Yeah,
the
right.
One that's
See, that's why children often take the blame. That's why I say when I ask kids to draw pictures of their family, I mean grade school kids, I mean the pictures are a horror. I mean because it's not a family. There's no family circle. Everybody's all over the place. No touching, no hugging, no activity together. You know, they're not all playing ball in the yard or in a swimming pool. Mommy's in the kitchen. Daddy's at work. My brother's in his room. I'm in the yard. I mean, it's sad to watch. And when divorce is involved, boy, there's a line down the middle of the page that nobody can break through. So, but the kids often feel to blame. I mean, here's a quote. See, again, when I said experience, woman develops cancer, is screaming at her surgeon for making her ugly with the incision, which is barely visible on her upper thigh, you know, unless she's wearing a skimpy bathing suit. And he sent her to me to see if I could figure out what's the emotional factor. I said to her, how do you describe your illness? She said, it's a failure. I said, how does that word fit your life? She said, well, my body failed. I said, that was not my question. I said, how does failure fit your life? She said, oh, my parents committed suicide when I was a child, so I must have been a failure as a child. Now, here's somebody who her entire life has never developed a relationship because of that event. See, because she's afraid I'll be hurt again. I'll get close to somebody, they'll kill themselves or leave her. Yeah, so she woke up that day, and the cancer started her on a new life. But, you know, when he talks about his father, you see, it's that same type of thing. I'm afraid I could be hurt by a relationship, by getting close to people. And when you haven't been touched, you have a different nervous system. When you're not touched as a child and we don't receive affection, you are a different human being. That's why it's loud music, aggression, noise. You don't feel or hear it the way others do.
Thank you. I just feel so connected to that letter. I don't know why. I guess I'll figure that out later. But there's another one here, too, that just breaks your heart. When I attempt to get my children to do their own chores and help around the house, my husband tells them that they don't have to do anything or that he will help them later and that they don't need to do anything now.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's easy to solve. Tomorrow night, let me just say this. See, tomorrow night when the husband comes into the kitchen and says, where's the supper, dear? You say, I don't have to do anything. And when I have to do it, you'll help me. Okay? Why is she different than the kids? So she has the same rights the kids have. They don't have to do anything. She doesn't have to do anything. And I think a lot of women forget how much power they have. And they become submissive instead of staying polite. I've met a lot of Southern women who make a big mistake and become submissive instead of, you know, Southern politeness. And what women have to realize is they have a lot of power. So just stop making dinner, stop cleaning the house, and quote your husband, they don't have to do anything, I don't have to do anything. I'm one of the kids, too. So when you're ready to clean the house and make dinner, let me know. We'll give you a hand.
Boy, I would think that would be hard for a lot of women, and I think men take advantage of that. I'm going to read the rest of her letter.
Go ahead.
Being the bad guy to the kids, and he's the loving, helping dad, but of course he never helps them, and they never end up getting their rooms clean. I don't know what to do when I'm being undermined this way. So your suggestion to her is that...
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, she can stop having sexual relationships with him. She can stop having dinner. She can do a hell of a lot of things. That, you know, and say to him, you got to wake up and pay attention to what's going on in this household. You're making me the bad guy. You act like the good guy, but you never fulfill your roles. And she's got to speak up, that's all. See, Joseph Campbell said a long time ago, and so did my wife, Joseph Campbell said marriage is an ordeal. Any relationship is, doctor, patient, or anything else. It's an ordeal. My wife calls it a struggle. Why? Because, as Campbell said, 1 + 1 = 3. See, two people are forming a third entity. It's a relationship. If you're interested in yourself, you don't create a relationship. So you tell your husband, you have a 60% responsibility for our marriage, and so do I. then you have a happy marriage because you're both putting time into the relationship, not who's right, who's wrong, how do you treat the kids. It's about the relationship, and relationships are work.
There's a P.S. here I didn't see. I don't want my kids to grow up thinking this is what marriage is about. Can you suggest a solution or one of your books that can help me get through this?
And, one book is called Prescriptions for Living, and this one, Love, Magic, and Mud Pies. I'd say both of them are, you know, short segments that tell you an experience, and then the magic is like an exercise, and what can I do to make this happen in my family? So Prescriptions for Living, Love, Magic, and Mud Pies. And I say that because it's interesting to me to look back at my books and realize, wow, there's a lot of wisdom in it, because I forget what I've written. So I reread them and keep learning. And, well, there's another one if you want something to help you get through the days. It's called 365 Prescriptions for the Soul. So each day you can read something, and that, again, would help you. You know, it's just like one page and a little message for the day. But I'd say those three, it could be very helpful. And ask your husband to read them. And ask him his reaction. See, that's how you'll know more about your husband. Go to a movie together. Ask him what he thinks when he comes out. Read a book, the same book, and see if his comments are opposite to yours. So somebody could be listening to this program and say, oh, this guy rambles on, and it's the same thing over and over again. And somebody else says, God, that was so inspiring. What's different isn't what I said, but the listeners. And that's why I say, if I'm coaching a football team or a baseball team and some of the kids show up for practice and stay an extra hour, yeah, I can really, you know, have something happen with them by coaching them. And then there are other kids who come in 20 minutes late and go home early and never practice, and what do you expect me to accomplish as a coach? I can't. So is your husband open to coaching? That's a big factor.
How can people get in touch with you?
Oh, the easiest is the website, Bernie Siegel, M.D., BERNIESIEGELMD.com, and they can email me directly through that.
Great, and where can they get your book, this wonderful little
book? Oh, all the,
book.
You know, Amazons and Barnes and Nobles and, you know, all the major bookstores, it should be there. And if
and
it isn't,
the name again?
Love, Magic, and Mud Pie.
Thank you very much for being with us. When the music goes loud, we got to go.
All right.
It's been delightful. Thank you.